Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Right now in oil, with a global view on what we've witnessed with cyber attacks in the United States, Amrita Sen joins us, Energy Aspects Director of Research and Chief Oil Analyst. Amrita, as you look at the distribution of hydrocarbons worldwide, how vulnerable are they to a cyber attack?
I mean, great question. I would say pretty much everywhere, more and more, I think everybody is. I mean, the Colonial Pipeline is a great example. But look at the Middle East. A lot of, even Upcake to that matter, there were elements of kind of cyber attacks involved in that. But even more recently, within the Middle East, you do get a lot of infrastructure, not necessarily disruptions, but targets. And I think this is just the new normal. There are more and more companies spending on this, and it just needs to get higher from here because, you know, it's not the warfare generally is changing. The landscape's completely changed.
I mean, in Malaysia, they're doing a 24-mile, 30-mile key pipeline having to do with the distribution. I believe it's up the west coast of Malaysia. How many spots do you perceive to be out there like the Colonial Pipeline worldwide? Is it 10 other hot spots or is it hundreds?
It's going to be hundreds because if you think about the distribution, I mean, if you're really going down that route, you're talking about a huge distribution or pipeline networks within China, within India, even Europe. Europe has a huge network, both for crude and for products.
Looking more broadly then, Amrita, when we talk to anyone in the commodity market right now, they're not concerned about this Colonial Pipeline shutdown. There's just a belief that we'll adjust, it'll come back online and we'll get back to normal. Any aspects of the infrastructure, the distribution in America, the transportation of energy that you would be concerned about?
No, I mean, not right now and not the scale at which this attack has happened. I do agree with what you just said. I think the pipeline and just generally everything should be back up and running in about 3 to 5 days. But, you know, never say never. It's definitely unprecedented in the scale at which it's happening. So it will require coordination from various government bodies, and that can take some time. I don't think there's going to be more. And I think after this attack, I do think a lot of U.S. networks, natural gas as well, let's not forget that, they will probably tighten up what they can do to protect their networks going forward.
Amrita, going forward from here, build on the other issues surrounding the oil market right now. We've talked a ton about supply. Let's talk about it a little bit more. Out of Iran, can we open things up a little bit more? What do negotiations look like? If you said 12, 18 months ago that we'd have a President Joe Biden, a Democratic sweep, we'd be talking potentially about loosening things up with Iran. Are we still having that discussion?
Yeah, we are. And, you know, we've always said that we're expecting some kind of a breakthrough over kind of April and May and then sanctions relief by July. I will say, however, talks are progressing, but progressing probably a bit slower than we've been expecting. No major changes. But the thing I will warn is that everybody is expecting a deal in the coming weeks and then sanctions relief over Q3. But if there isn't a deal before the Iranian elections, which are next month, that's the thing to watch out for, because then it could get dragged on and then the deal becomes a 2022 story. I don't think that's in the price at all.
What is the link, Amrita, that you see between oil as a huge weighting of CRB or the Bloomberg Commodity Index with all the other commodities? They don't trade in lockstep, do they?
No, not at all. And I mean, if you guys were saying as well, just I mean, S&P at record highs, but if you look at metals markets are soaring, and you know, oil has been a very strong performer this year, but still hasn't been as strong as some of the other commodities. And part of that is because, you know, transportation was the worst hit during COVID. It is coming back, but it's not fully back yet. But there's also so much kind of talks around working from home. How much are we going to lose permanently for oil demand? But I mean, I will say this, all the data we're getting right now, personal incomes are back at pre-COVID levels in many, many parts of the world. I think this summer is going to be huge. People are going to spend, and the bounce back in oil demand is probably going to be significantly more than people have been expecting.
That is the line that Jeff Currie at Goldman's pushing too. Amrita, it sounds like you're on the same page. It's good to hear from you. Amrita Sen there of Energy Aspects.
We're talking about this huge environmental transition on top of a demand boom too.
Right.
Trying to pin some of that as well. So the traditional cyclical read that you might get from copper, it's a little bit distorted this time around, given the political environment that we're in at the moment.
Now, the clear message of 2021 being different from 2002 from Mr. Currie at Goldman Sachs, and that has always been a consistent theme with Ian Bremmer of Eurasia Group, whose books are too many to mention. I can pick one of them, one of their titles, and say it is also about this moment. We welcome Dr. Bremmer this morning as we speak of every nation for itself. Dr. Bremmer, once again, food dynamics, rice in Cambodia really matters, rice in America less so. What is the food dynamic that you observe of this commodity lift?
It just tells me that the gap between rich and poor countries on the back of the pandemic and the rebound from the pandemic is being felt so, so greatly differently. You know, this is that you already have before the pandemic, you had about a quarter, for example, of everyone in Yemen being food stressed, not being able to have enough to eat. In Sudan, numbers are similar. Those numbers are doubling on the back of the pandemic right now. One of the most disheartening statistics that was indirect from the pandemic was the fact that we had an increase of about 50 million of extreme poor people around the world. The first time that number's gone up in well over in generations, I think it's like 40 years since that number's increased year on year. That's you know, that means food insecurity. That's first and foremost the most important thing that's going to be that hit. And you're going to see that play out in so many of these countries where these prices have gone up and the governments don't have any capacity
right
to provide support.
Ian, I'm sure you saw Ramachandra Guha's magnificent essay in the FT, I'm going to say 10 days ago, about the collapse of his India. Do you at Eurasia Group look at this pandemic and the horrific news from India is being politically and Eurasia Group destabilizing for the region?
It's not destabilizing inside India. You know, India's Prime Minister Modi, despite having incredibly badly mishandled the last wave of this crisis is still, you know, the popularity base that he had was higher coming in than that of any other major leader. So he has a long way to go before you talk about domestic instability. Domestic opposition would have a long way to strengthen before they could be cohesive and really pose a challenge to him. But there's no question that when you see the India variant spreading as much as it is across Southeast Asia now, when you see the fact that the Indians, who have been the largest producers of vaccines around the world, and now they have massive shortages inside their own country, they've had to suspend all export. Most of that export was going to other countries in the region. So this is now where the broader epicenter of coronavirus crisis is. It's India, but it's also South and Southeast Asia. It's also the region that's going to have some of the least capacity to actually fight it. And by the way, the India-based and Chinese-based vaccines aren't as effective as the mRNA vaccines. I mean, I saw some extremely disturbing news. I don't know if you noticed this from the Seychelles. Seychelles has had more vaccine rollout than any other country in the world for their small population. They now also have more human-to-human spread per capita in cases, new cases, than India. That's astonishing. And that's because most of the vaccines are coming from China, and they don't have the efficacy in stopping spread. That's, a serious problem for the developing world.
Yep.
Right now largely isn't about Moderna and Pfizer, which has much more efficacy. So, yeah, I'm actually quite worried about what this is going to look like over the coming months.
How the West can help, that's the big question right now. And I've got to say, the answer to that question is sowing some real division between Europe and the United States at the moment. The U.S., as you know, Ian, tried to suspend IP protection, at least trying to push that issue through the WTO. And then you've got Europe turning around and saying, well, we don't think that's going to help. Germany's looking at the United States for hoarding vaccines and not exporting them. What did you make of the U.S. decision last week, Ian, without bringing the allies on board? Because this is playing out quite publicly, and it did so through the weekend.
Yeah, this is playing out publicly. But, you know, the funny thing, first of all, I mean, the German response that this is not the way to actually provide help in the near term. That's true. I mean, it would take a very long time. We're talking about not just weeks or months where there's urgent need right now, but a year or more to get the kind of manufacturing capacity that would be aligned with just opening up the patent. So it's important symbolically for a lot of progressives in the Democratic Party, and Biden will benefit from that. But this isn't what's going to move the needle for the problem that we just talked about. The big issue is that here's the Biden administration trying to do the right thing and not coordinating with allies in advance. That's the mistake. It feels just like the announcement to leave Afghanistan. I mean, when your allies are absolutely critical, you shouldn't be in a position where the German government, where the EU is caught blindsided by you saying you're going to suspend IP protection. The Americans, in talking about helping the rest of the world in terms of this pandemic, we need to be talking in advance of our announcements with all of the key allies. It's such an easy thing to do. The Biden team should be good at this. This is where they're falling down.
Begs the question, Ian, why aren't they?
I think because they're used to, these are experienced men and women that have been around foreign policy establishment for decades. And for them, you know, multilateralism means the United States does the right thing and other allies just go along with us. It doesn't mean that we actually might be wrong or might have to compromise, because we've been in a position of such strength and because the alliance itself has been so much more cohesive. That's not as true today. Part of that has been 4 years of the Trump administration, but part of that is just Europe itself is moving in a different direction. They're feeling of their social contract, their feeling of the effectiveness of their representative democracy just is different than that of the United States right now. And I think we're living that experience.
Dr. Bremer, your top risks of 2021, you have been out front in saying we have to pay attention to cyber. You talk about a cyber tipping point in January, and here we are talking about it for real with this pipeline across the nation. Give us an update on the tipping point you see.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, I don't think the tipping point is between the U.S. and Russia, between the U.S. and China, because there is a level of deterrence on cyber attacks between those countries. We do espionage against them. They do espionage against us. We use the data in ways that are useful for us, but we don't break things. We don't go in and destroy critical infrastructure. We don't take the kind of actions that could precipitate a kinetic response, a hot war, where when you, the problem is that unlike nukes, where you had that nuclear balance, but those were only the only countries that had that capacity in the Cold War. In the case of cyber, you know, we stopped the Iranians from developing nukes. We're trying to get back into a deal to do that. We haven't stopped them from developing some of the world's most effective offensive cyber capabilities. Criminal networks in Russia, in Eastern Europe, in the United States, around the world have incredibly sophisticated cyber capacity to destroy things. Mm-hmm. And we see that with the smash and grab both on the data of this critical pipeline over the weekend, but also in the ransomware attack to shut them down. And, you know, there we just don't have cyber defenses to deal with this. I've particularly worried that they were going to shut down hospitals in the middle of vaccine rollout. You know, in the early days, that was something they were clearly capable of doing, these criminal networks. And thankfully for us, they didn't. But the vulnerability is massive.
Ian, it's good to catch up, as always. Ian Bremer, Eurasia Group president and founder. Let's bring in Jared Woodard, shall we? Bank of America Securities head of research, investment committee. Can we just start with the supply side at the moment, Jared? Whether it's the Colonial Pipeline and the issues there, we can solve them with higher prices if you want to import some gasoline from Europe. If it's the labor market shortage, you can hire, put up wages. What are you seeing, that dynamic on the supply side? Can it all be addressed with higher prices?
Well, some of it can be addressed, not all of it. I mean, semiconductors is the big one, I think, that's affected even the labor market possibly in that latest report. And semis is going to take a little while to sort out as far as we can tell. But it's also not, you know, a sort of catastrophe. But most of the big headlines, whether it's in commodities or in labor, we think can be addressed with higher prices, higher wages. And, you know, it's a kind of a two-period market, I think. Everyone's ready and I think properly should be strapped in for what could be a very wild summer. But if we look ahead 6 months, we look to the end of the year, we expect fairly normal conditions, even inflation, back down to levels that were more consistent with what we saw, you know, before the pandemic.
Sign-on bonuses, transitory. Jared, you've made this point. The conversation Tom and I were having earlier this morning, 10 minutes ago, on the labor market, Stifel offering an appreciation bonus, UBS for certain bankers getting a bonus if they get a promotion. That is all discretionary spending, Jared, in terms of just the extra bonus. It's not base salary. And Jared, I just wonder from your perspective whether that plays into the Fed's hands a little bit on the labor market, that on either end of the wage spectrum, we're talking about bonuses and we're not talking about higher base.
Yeah, this is exactly what the Fed wants, I think. If you're worried about long-term wage price spiral, I think you can relax a little bit here, because a signing bonus is not a raise. You know, whether it's $50 to show up for a McDonald's, you know, job interview, or
that's what I
know,
got
10,000 or 40. Yeah, then I mean, or at the high end, these higher bonuses at the high end, these are not permanent salary increases. If they were, that's a different conversation. But so far, there's no evidence of anything persistent, yeah, because employers and workers both understand that, again, 6 to 9 months from now, things are probably going to be a lot more normal than we expect.
Yeah, John, it was great. Al from New Jersey sent me a $50 check and said, I'm sure there's change left over.
How did you get on at McDonald's?
I don't know. It was great.
I got can't imagine you at McDonald's.
Number two value meal and, you know, a coffee.
That's you eating at McDonald's.
I went large. I got the extra large fries just to get me through the day. Jared, you have a single sentence in your note that's just so, so important and really wise. You got to have the courage to buy inflation surge when there's no inflation. But then what do you do when inflation expectations finally go? What do you do when the expectations of inflation are finally there? Do you sell?
Well, look, let's look a little bit of history. Okay. Our economists expect, I think, 3.6% CPI this quarter. You know, I think that's exactly right. And if you look at what's happened in the past, we've seen inflation surges above, say, 3.5%. Just the past 30 years, there's been quite a few of those occasions. We looked at market, you know, impact, market data around those prints. And if you bought all the inflation trades, the commodities, you know, Europe versus US, et cetera, on those occasions, past 30 years, on average, 1 year later, your inflation trades lost money. Now, so to me, that says that if you believe the inflation trade now, you know, is something you have to buy when it's already priced into the market, some of those trades have already done really well, then you've got to be convinced that this is the big one. And we just don't see any evidence of that. Instead, we think investors still have to keep a kind of a balanced approach. Within the inflation trades, within the reflation trades, we still like financials very much. But I think that the commodities, the materials, the energy, there's just not enough evidence on that on that side. And if you do see more dips, more corrections even, in the tech and the growth kind of trades, for a long-term investor, those have to be viable opportunities.
Jared, what do you think of the FANGs? David Kostin is at the Death Star Goldman Sachs making a big splash this weekend on valuation of the FANGs. Do you agree that the FANGs actually offer value given their growth characteristics versus the 10-year yield?
I think they're trading vehicles, you know, perhaps at this point, some of these big mega cap growth trades. And so you can, they're almost kind of like a macro expression of what's going to happen with growth and inflation, but they're not. I don't think people are looking at them as deep value by any means. If you like the sort of the tech and growth type stocks, I think small and mid caps are more attractive here.
Jared, caught up with Rick Rieder at BlackRock a couple of days ago on Friday, and he was talking about running a higher cash position across some of the portfolios, something in the double digits, mid teens maybe. Jared, does that make sense going into the summer to have that dry powder?
I think it does make sense to have some cash ready to deploy. If it's a question of something tactical to be ready if there's some big dislocations, you know, on either end, we could see overheated reflation trades that, you know, you want to sell to go rotate back into growth. You could see the reverse where we get another bad job sprint and people start to really get gloomy. Either case, you want to have cash ready. I don't think it's a good moment to be sort of allocating higher permanent portfolio positions into cash or anything else that's going to change your fundamental mix. Because right now, you know, there's so many cross currents, you can roll the dice and any analyst can tell you any number of 10 different things. When there's that much confusion in the market, that much confusion in the labor data, I don't think it's a good time to make permanent decisions.
So just quickly though, Jared, what would fund that position? Would you trim broadly or somewhere specific?
Well, I would trim some of the mega cap stocks, whether it's tech or otherwise. My colleague Savita Subramanian's, I think, been fairly, neutral on some of the mega cap stocks for a while, and at the bank we're much more favorable on small and mid caps. So I think that the trades that have already done very well, the really liquid names, are the obvious places to look for cash, and that can even include investment grade credit for multi asset portfolios. We're kind of bearish on that part of the credit market and see better opportunities elsewhere.
Hey Jared, good to see you. Great to catch up on a range of issues. Jared Woodard there, Bank of America Securities Head of Research Investment Committee.
This is the right person at the right time to talk about the retail cadence of America. Friday, we get retail from the lowest price point to the highest price point. And Steve Sadov is expert at this. Mr. Sadov is with MasterCard, senior advisor, but that barely describes his contribution to retail. Herbal Essence and all that boom a million years ago in shampoo, it's Sadov's fault. And he's the guy at Saks who brought us exclusives, literally inventing that out of pixie dust. Steve Sadov, let me talk about MasterCard and the knowledge that MasterCard has tick by tick. And you say it even goes over to department stores are enjoying this resurgence.
Good to see you, Tom. And yeah, I think that the month of April, the MasterCard Spending Pulse numbers show that the consumer is really coming back with a vengeance. You saw overall sales, and this is now not just the MasterCard sales, but it cuts across all forms of tender. Sales were up 23.3% versus year ago, but importantly, they were up 10.8% versus 19. And this is ex auto and gas. So you're seeing a consumer that's coming back, and it's across all sectors. You mentioned department stores, but it's in restaurants. It's in the categories like jewelry and apparel. Yeah. And you're starting to see the consumer saying, hey, I want to get back out again.
Let me ask you a sell side question then. Are we pulling forward next autumn sales? Are we redoing the closet now where nothing ebbs as we go into the holiday season? What is that dynamic?
Well, there's no question that we're redoing our closets. We've been wearing sweatpants for the last year, and you're seeing a new fashion cycle starting. The guys in the jean business are all talking about baggier, higher waists. It's a new newness, excitement. Getting out again, and you're seeing it hit just the apparel fashion, but you're seeing it in the handbags, the shoes, the jewelry. So I don't know that it's necessarily pulling forward the volume from the fall because there's so much pent-up demand and savings that's out there. And the interesting thing is it's not just online anymore. Online is now 21% of all commerce and growing still at 20%, but people are back in the stores. And brick and mortar is starting to see that pent up demand.
Steve, I'm going to avoid the baggy higher waist thing. Somehow I don't think the higher waist jeans are going to work on me as well. Steve, you are a student of all this. And if I can move up the scale to luxury and such, will there be a consolidation? We have luxury, which is three big French companies. You know it better than me. But how do we come out of this on an equity basis? Further consolidation, or is it going to be entrepreneurial with IPOs and the rest?
I think it's going to be a combination of both. You have the strong ones are going to be picking off some of the big brands. You'll see the consolidation for the LVMHs and the Richemonts of the world. But you're seeing companies like the Tapestries performing much better. I think you're going to continue to see these niche segmented brands that come out and do their IPOs. The consumer wants values. They want a story. And I think that in the luxury space, you're going to continue to see a lot of innovation.
Steve Sadov, to bring it back to MasterCard and your work for them now as a senior advisor, how is our relationship with our cards changing? There's a lot of dynamics in fintech and digital dynamics. How does MasterCard model that forward?
Well, I think what you have is a consumer that is going much more cashless so that they want touchless, they want ease of transaction, they still love their cards. And I think that it bodes very well for the MasterCards of the world in terms of the changing behaviors. And it's not just the transaction, it's what you do with some of the data and the analytics and the ability to understand consumers better. I think that this is the value-added proposition that all of these the retailers need. And you're seeing a lot more of that coming out of the use of data in meeting the consumer needs on a level of one.
What is the permanent change of the consumer out of this natural disaster we've all lived?
I think the consumer go back to the value and values. They want to be safe. They want to be able to get what they want when they want it. This omnichannel shopping is here to stay. These are some fundamental changes that had started earlier before the pandemic that have probably accelerated 6 years over the last year in terms of the shift to omnichannel and segmented and differentiated brands.
You just described Amazon. They're doing an 8-tranche offering today of $1 gazillion in bonds. How does Amazon adapt to the Steve Sadov world?
Oh, Amazon's a winner. I think the Amazons, the Walmarts, the Targets continue to do well. Doesn't mean they're the only ones that are going to do well, but marketplaces are important in this environment. They're not going to, Amazon's not the only marketplace. You're going to have the Farfetches of the world that will do well. But the consumer loves convenience, ease. Amazon sets the standards. The way that they do the presentation of the product, they understand the personalization, that's going to be the expectation. Amazon's a winner over time, but I think that there's going to be a lot of others as well. And you also have these new evolving, whether it's the resale, the rental, all of this is this new age in terms of how retail's evolving.
Steve Sadov, does Amazon take luxury from luxury? I mean, is Gucci going to actually sell off Amazon?
My guess is the answer is probably not. I think that the Gucci's and the LVMH's are going to play in other kinds of marketplaces. Maybe they'll play in the Farfetch's, the Net-a-Porter's, the Saks.com, which is separated from the full-line stores. I don't know that those brands play in the Amazon world, but Amazon will play very – they'll be the major player in apparel. I'm just not so sure it's going to be at the very high-end luxury.
It's been too long. Steve Sadov, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. Inventing retail and exclusives at Saks and, of course, at MasterCard as a senior advisor. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.